UK Wine Show, show number 182 for the 13th of November, 2009. Jamie Good on Grape Biology. Good day to you all in Podland and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and this week we've got another great show. We're getting down and dirty with Jamie Good looking at the biology of the vine, how it works, and why it does what it does. Jamie's been on the show before. As well as being an influential wine blogger and newspaper writer, Jamie is a doctor of plant biology. We're going to be talking to him about how vines grow. In the spotlight, we're looking at Michael Schuster's essential wine tasting book. This is the latest revision of the book, which we reviewed about a year and a half ago. I also have a copy to give away, and once again, I'll be able to ship it to anywhere in the world, so do stay tuned for that later on in the show. But before we get into the news, we're going to have our mystery wine region. As normal, I'm going to give you two sets of clues, and you have to see which wine region you think it is I'm talking about. And then I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So, our region is an American viticultural area at the northern tip of San Juan Valley in California, just southeast of San Francisco Bay. Here, at the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains, with some 800 growers farming 100,000 acres of vines on fertile and diverse soils. I'll give you the next clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. There are great expectations for the 2009 vintage Beaujolais, ahead of Beaujolais Nouveau Day, which arrives this year on Thursday the 19th of November 2009. Every year, remember, it's on the third Thursday of November. Beaujolais' biggest wine producer, Georges Debouf, is more than enthusiastic about this year's harvest, predicting it as one of the best Beaujolais vintages in 50 years. In New York and Miami, his wines will be promoted in a week-long celebration with Peace, Love and Beaujolais Nouveau Vintage V-Dub Love Buses, escorted by Beaujolais biker chefs and wine-loving hippies. They'll deliver the first cases of Georges Debouf Beaujolais to the official sip-in uncorking ceremonies. All sounds really exciting.
I'm sure Georges' Beaujolais Nouveau is going to taste fine. Perhaps not as fine as some of the Beaujolais that came out last year with all that illegal sugar added to them and were banned. Hopefully they'll be pretty good as well. It'll be interesting to see how much coverage they manage to squeeze out in the UK. That said, I may just pick up a bottle next week myself. Hopefully I'm going to enjoy it enough so I don't tip it down the sink. What's the story about the waste of wine in the UK, Jane?
Well, according to figures collated for RAP, the Waste and Resource Action Programme, British households are pouring £470 million worth of wine down the plug hole every year. These figures are based on data from diaries kept by 309 households to record wasted food and drink items. The most wasted drink is milk, followed by fizzy soft drinks and fruit juice. But rather than pouring away unfinished wine, RAP, which is government funded, remember, is urging people to freeze it and use it in cooking sauces and casseroles as part of the campaign to reduce the nation's carbon footprint. Currently, 1.8 million tonnes of food and drink in UK homes is wasted. A RAP spokeswoman said the organisation wasn't suggesting that consumers should drink wine that's been defrosted, but said that leftovers could easily be used for cooking. Apparently, lots of cooks pour dregs from bottles into ice cube trays so they can easily freeze them for use in sauces.
I know I tip vast quantities of wine out each month. For example, this Saturday just been, I came home with 18 half bottles of wine from our one-day wine course I ran. All delicious wines, but really hard to get through so many before they oxidise and before I can enjoy them. I have been using an inert gas which seems to be doing a much better job at keeping the wines fresher for longer, but still haven't heard where I can get it from the high street. Anybody have any ideas? Otherwise, I think I'll still be tipping it out, although having a bag full of frozen wine sounds quite good for our sauces. Might put it in my special sauce. Okay, what's the last story, Jane?
Well, on a more sombre note, administrators of First Quench Retailing have announced a further 35 job losses at head office, and that they're closing 373 loss-making stores, which is going to result in 1,738 redundancies across the group. The group includes Threshers, Wine Rack, Victoria Wine and Bottoms Up. Stock is being sold off at a discount in these stores, which will close between the 25th of November and the 2nd of December, or sooner if stock runs out. The remaining stores are said to be trading well, and it's hoped a buyer will be secured over the coming weeks. For details of the stores to be closed, check out the website at threshergroup.com. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website to read these stories in full, www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. One item that didn't make it into the news, mainly because I don't think it was particularly surprising, was from the Journal of Nutrition Research, who published a paper on wines and teeth and discovered that white wines are worse for your teeth than red wines. I always thought it was sort of along those lines because white wines tend to have higher acidity. But in the abstract I read, it appeared that the range of pHs were measured and this variable was removed. But calcium loss from your teeth was much higher for white wines than for reds. Not quite sure why, but I think at some point in the future I'd like to do a show looking at how our teeth are affected by wines. So if there's any dentists out there who know lots about wine and teeth, give me a call, chris.scott@3050.co.uk. But next up, we have our spotlight, and this week we're going to be reviewing Michael Schuster's Essential Wine Tasting 2009 revision. Quite a catchy title, isn't it? Okay. Without a doubt, Michael Schuster's Essential Wine Tasting is the definitive book for those who want to learn how to taste wine. Designed as a mini course, it certainly gives those who follow its tasting recommendations a solid understanding of wine. For me, there's nothing more boring than listening to a review or reading about someone else tasting wine, which is why we don't do it on this show. After all, wine is something to be explored and savoured yourself. But in the Essential Wine Tasting, Michael gives examples of wines to try within a well-structured and focused lesson. For example, how do you learn the difference between sweetness and sugar and sweetness from alcohol? Well, for me, the most interesting tasting exercise didn't involve wine, but it involved water, sugar, vodka and lemon, and it explains sweetness and much, much more. This 2009 revised edition has updates to wines to try, which is great, as the last version I looked at about 18 months ago was getting a bit out of date. But apart from the cover and some pictures in the book, there seems to be little change in the contents. But sadly, I don't have the earlier version, so I couldn't check word for word for you guys. I lent it to someone who needed a solid understanding in wine tasting, and I never saw it back, so hopefully they enjoyed it as much as I did. If you already have a copy of the book, though, I do not recommend rushing out and buying the latest copy. But if you are looking to hone your tasting techniques, then this is an excellent starting point. It's approachable and easy to understand, and a rather slim 192-page book has all the information to go from a novice taster to a professional. I rated this book the same as last time, as 91 out of 100. So, definitely a good book. I do have a copy to give away to a listener, and it can be anywhere in the world again this time. So, if you'd like to win a copy of the book, simply email me at chris.scott@3050.co.uk. If you've got any feedback on the show, it'd be most appreciated. I've been really enjoying getting lots of feedback as people enter the book, so it's given me some ideas for shows in the future as well. Don't forget to include your name and your physical address so we know where to send the book. And this is going to be the last book we're going to be giving away for a while, so don't miss out on what is an excellent book. If you did miss out in any of the other books and you'd like to get them, you can pick up the wines. The last three books we've had, that's the Hugh Johnson Wine Companion, the World Wine Atlas, and the Essential Wine Tasting. I've spoken to the publisher, and if you buy it directly from the publisher, they'll give 40% discount off the list price. There's going to be a link on the wine reviews. You can get to that by going to 3050.co.uk, click on the UK Wine Show, and then click on the book reviews. Then click on the book you want, and it'll turn up. Well, I think I should have got paid for that ad break, but I do rate these books, and I will announce the winner next week. And this book, along with the two others we've given away, are going to be in the mail next week. So do keep an eye out for that if you were a winner. But next up, we need to finish off our mystery wine region with the last of the two clues. So, our mystery American wine region has a Mediterranean-style climate of warm days and cool evenings, and the temperature is moderated by gentle maritime winds from the Sacramento River Delta. Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, and Zinfandel are big grapes grown here, but others are now flourishing, such as Petit Serrat, Cabernet Franc, Viognier, Grassinio, Tempranillo, and Albarino. However, Zinfandel remains supreme. More of this is grown here than anywhere in the world, and old vine Zinfandel is a speciality. Okay, I'm going to give you the answer to the mystery region after our interview, which is coming up next with Dr. Jamie Good, plant biologist. Plant biologist. Jamie is a leading wine blogger with the website wineanorak.com, as well as being a writer for the Sunday Express. Let's have a listen to what he has to say about the old Vitis vinifera's biology. Hi, I'm here with Jamie Good, plant biologist or doctor of plant biology.
Well, Chris, to be more accurate, I'd probably call myself a lapsed plant biologist.
Lapsed plant biologist.
It's been quite a while since I did any research. So I did a degree and then a PhD in plant biology, which is great fun. That was about 15 years ago. But I've obviously kept an interest in science.
And particularly
applying that knowledge of plant biology to grapevines, which is my particular interest at the moment.
Excellent. So today, if Rosie doesn't eat everything while we're here, she's sauntered off ignoring us. That's good. We're going to be talking a wee bit about plant respiration and how plants actually exist, in particular the grapevine. Before we crack into it a wee bit more, what's the natural environment for grapevines? You know, they've always been on trellises.
I think it's really quite helpful to start thinking about grapevine biology. And a good way to start thinking about that is to think in terms of what is the grapevine adapted to do. You know, all plants are adapted for a particular environment or niche, and the grapevine's niche or environment is to be a woodland climber. So the grapevine, you can think of it as the freeloader of the plant world. It's decided it building its own trunk to get it higher up enough in a woodland environment that it catches the sunlight, which is one of the things that plants in a wood are competing for most, is sunlight.
Yep.
It's too much effort. So what the grapevines decided to do is to hitch a ride with other plants. So the specific biology of grapevines is that they're designed to be very effective climbers. So what happens is that every now and then along the grapevine shoot, you've got tendrils, and tendrils are designed to reach out and grab hold of bits of other plants or trees and act as an anchor point. And then once the tendrils attach, then the shoot just carries on growing very rapidly and very long up the tree until the grapevine itself reaches the canopy of the host tree where it can find some light. And so what the grapevine's got is it's got these very thin shoots that really can't support themselves. It's got a very effective root system because what it's got to do is it's got to compete for nutrients and water with existing trees that it's growing up. So the grapevine root is specially adapted to working with getting nutrients and water out where there isn't much there against the competition from other plants. So as you can see, the grapevine therefore is good at surviving in conditions where there isn't much water, and it's good at surviving in conditions where there's low nutrient availability. And then if you look at the shoot, what happens is the shoot goes up there, and when it comes to fruit production, what the grapevine does is it's got to produce fruit where the birds can find it, because basically grapes are for the birds.
Not for me to drink wine.
Not for you to drink wine, no. The grapevine is certainly not designed for us to make wine from it. The cue that signals the developmental choice for the structures that form the flowers and they're the grape buds is light.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at a grapevine, you see that these the tendrils and the flowers are very similar structures initially, and it's light and particularly the amount of light that structure that then forms the tendril or the flower has received the previous growing season that decides whether this is going to become a flower or a tendril.
So either or could happen. It just depends. Yeah. But tendrils grow quite. You can see tendrils as the shoot grows up. The tendril will form anyway, as the shoot's growing, so it does form irrespective.
Yes.
So you're talking about the older wood, whether it grows another tendril?
No. What I'm talking about is that the latent buds for the tendrils form the previous growing season.
Oh, yeah.
And they're hidden away in the axils of the shoots. So what happens is that these structures, you can go to your vine in spring and even before flowering, and you can dissect these buds out and look and see whether they're going to become flowers or tendrils. And that can help you with predicting your potential crop for the season. You know, if you know just how many flower clusters you're going to get. You've got an idea of what sort of yield you might have.
I suppose you can control how many bunches you get by exposing the vine.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why sunlight is so critical. In the canopy management is so important, because if your canopy's all dense and sunlight doesn't get through, then your yield next year could suffer because the buds that are forming for the following year's flowers won't have seen the sunlight, and so won't have made this developmental switch to form flowers as opposed to tendrils.
The vine's at the top of the tree, so
yes.
It's a bit hanging out there. The season's gone on. It's been up there for a year. It's had a bit of sunlight on the tendrils or the buds, and it's going to shoot some fruit. Is that right?
It's going to shoot some fruit, man. I like it. I like it, Chris. Very good. No. So the sunlight's the thing that says this is a good place to make grapes rather than...
What about in countries where, like in Australia, they use a lot of canopy to shield the grapes from sunburn?
Well, they're still going to see enough light. The reason they're using the canopies is because there's an abundance of light. Mm-hmm. And so if you're using the canopy to shield the grapes from getting burnt, the wood or the cane is still going to see enough sunlight that you're going to get a good production of fruit the next season.
Okay. And you're saying earlier around veraison, that's not really... Because I always think veraison is like the start of the ripening process.
Yeah. Birds like grapes a little bit that would make rubbish wine, basically. The reason that what happens is the grapes all start off green. And in a native environment, hundreds of thousands of years ago or maybe older, all the grapes would have been red. Mm. The wild grapes were red. The white grapes that we use now have come from a mutation or a series of mutations that basically changed the grape color. And so in the woods, the grapes start out green, and they're unpalatable. Yep. They've got high acids, high tannins, very bitter. And basically what happens is...
And even the birds don't like that.
The birds don't like that. So the grape changes color, and the veraison is an indication to the birds to come and get me. You know, this is time. I'm ready to be eaten. And the seeds have reached a point where it's okay for the birds to eat them and then go and disperse them. But if you were to make wine from those grapes just as they turned red, it would be absolutely appalling. Obviously, we to make wine, you need to get very high sugar levels. We want to pick the grapes a lot riper. Then you'd need to have them even to eat them.
As far as the grapes are concerned, it's ripe at veraison in terms of the seeds. So the seeds are viable.
Yeah.
But we don't like them because there's not enough sugar there.
Yeah.
What about, like, some vineyards get infested by birds? Yeah. Would they be a lot better to grow white grapes in those regions because the birds won't notice them so much? Or
I see what you're saying, but I think that, the white grapes aren't as obvious, but they're still pretty obvious. If you think about the natural environment in the middle of a canopy of a tree, then you really need to make the grapes stand out. In a vineyard, the white grapes still stand out pretty much to the birds, even though they're... they wouldn't necessarily stand out in the canopy of a tree.
So they'd just try it. Oh, this is good to eat now.
Once a bird's tried it and eaten it, then they learn to, this keep is a going. Good food source, and they'll keep going,
So veraison, well, I suppose one of the key things with veraison is then, and I think you touched on this before we recorded, the grapes are almost hidden from the birds, and then when they change, then they become more obvious. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk a wee bit about respiration, because I've got this weird view in my head about how plant circulation works, and I think I've got it wrong, but I always thought that the roots absorb the water, and through capillary action that carried the nutrients up to the plant, and then an evaporation sort of took the water away from the leaves. Is that wrong or right? Or
it's not wrong. I mean, basically what happens, plants take up from the water, sorry, from the soil, they take up water and inorganic ions, nutrients. The process of taking these up is water obviously is taken up passively, and as you say, it's driven by the
passively,
as in it's not an energy requiring process.
The
water comes in because the concentration of water in the roots is less than outside, and so there's an osmotic gradient, so water's taken up that way.
It's just like a sponge, and the transfer
through the plant of water takes place through the xylem. It's a specialized conducting tissue. The vascular tissue in plants consists of xylem and phloem, as you probably remember from school.
No, I don't. That's the trouble. Biology wasn't my strong point. Was it xylem?
So the xylem and phloem. The xylem is like conducting cells, and the xylem conducts water and these inorganic ions, so nutrients, And that conducts it through the body of the plant, and that's driven by evaporation at one end, capillary action, and evaporation. And the other conducting tissue is phloem. And phloem circulates the photosynthates, which are the sugars, throughout the plant. So what the plant does, it takes up these inorganic ions and water.
Yep.
And the inorganic ions are taken up actively as well as passively, which means that energy is used to take them up because the plant wants these
Yep.
So it has these specialised pumps in the root tissue, these molecular pumps that pump in to the root cells the particular inorganic ions that it wants, you know, like magnesium or nitrogen. Or it then takes those through the, you know, as you know, through sunlight, acting on the greenness of the plants, because it has this compound called chlorophyll in it, which is a specialized compound that's arranged in special structures that then converts sunlight into energy.
Yep.
And using this energy, then
it converts the energy sugar, is it?
Or yes, the sugars. Yep. And then what happens is that using the inorganic ions and the sugars, the plant's able to synthesize everything it needs, including itself. Uh-huh. And so these photosynthates, the sugars, are taken around the plant by the phloem, which is the other specialized conducting tissue.
Yep.
And that's a bit more complex, the way that the phloem works in transporting.
So the plant's actually using energy to transport that around the plant.
Yes.
Okay, whereas the water and the organic ions are just go. Can it control it? Is it like, what's driving it? Because I always think of plants as more responsive as opposed to a planned layout.
A plant is... Plant biology is pretty sophisticated. Plants are effectively environmental computers. What they're doing is they're stuck there. And what we do, we regulate our environment by moving around. If it's too cold, we move to somewhere warmer, or we stick a jumper on.
Yeah.
You know, if it's too hot, we can take aversive action from things that if there's a predator, we'll run away from the predator. What plants do is plants are stuck in one place. So they have to... respond in the best way they can to their environment. So plants are very good at detecting environmental cues like light, heat, even touch. And then they turn those through complex signaling pathways. They then respond to these environmental cues by growing in particular ways or synthesizing certain compounds. For instance, a plant, it's sitting there, it's a target for predators who want to eat it. So plants manufacture a whole range of what are called secondary metabolites, specialized compounds that act as antifeedants or poisonous. Yep. And they can also protect themselves with physical structures. I mean, a tree is pretty solid. Or it can protect itself with spines or all these things a plant can do to make it survive in a particular environment.
Yeah.
And the grapevine does all this sort of stuff as well. You know, it responds very... to environmental cues in specific ways. And what viticulture is trying to do is we're trying to encourage the vine to respond in the ways that produces the best quality fruit. And, you know, often plants, if they're in a very good environment, they can make choices between vegetative growth and reproduction and sexual reproduction.
Yeah.
And often plants, if they're
when you say sexual, you mean
as in producing fruit. Yeah. Often plants in a very nice environment just concentrate on growing big, and their energy is, because this is a good place to grow, so we'll hang around here. This is nice.
Yeah.
And if the environment's a bit hostile, the plant says, "Blow me down. This isn't a nice place to be growing." So we'll spread ourselves by, we'll reproduce sexually. So with a grapevine is a slightly uncomfortable environment for grapevine. We'll put its energies into fruit production rather than growing big. If you plant a grapevine in very fertile soil, the grapevine just puts all its energy into producing this massive canopy.
Yep.
And the fruit's kind of rubbish. So you want to treat the grapevine a little bit mean.
I was talking to a viticulturist called Richard Smart.
Yeah, he's a very famous viticulturist.
And he seems to think that treating a vine mean to keep it keen is not necessarily the best thing.
Yeah, he's obviously a very talented viticulturist, and he's very influential. And he thinks you can have your cake and eat it, effectively, with viticulture. So he thinks you can have a big canopy in a fertile soil and produce large yields of good quality fruit.
Yeah.
That's quite controversial, though, really.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously...
He's quite a controversial fella.
Yeah. No, but the received wisdom in the wine world, for what it's worth, is that you can't have everything, you know. Yeah. If you want good quality, you have to cut your yields back a bit.
Can you manage the canopy so it produces better fruit by chopping it off? Does that make any difference? Obviously, things like pruning the canes reduces the amount of possible foliage that a vine will produce, or at least controls.
I mean, basically, what viticulturalists are trying to do is they're trying to get a balanced vine. They're trying to get a vine that has adequate canopy growth to support and ripen the fruit, because this is the factories, the leaves are the factories, so they're producing the energy, but you want the vine to actually then ripen the fruit properly, and produce a good yields of properly ripened fruit and to have even ripeness and to have nice balance in the canopies. And that's what viticulturists are working to. And that will depend on the site. Each site has specific characteristics.
Yeah.
And it's about adapting your viticulture to produce the right results in the site that you're on.
In some places, they talk about exposing the fruit to the light,
yes,
to get light into the fruit. And that does things like if you're high in altitude and you give it a lot of light, you get a lot of UV light, the fruit gets thicker, deeper color, things like that. But you also talked about the leaves and that being the factories. Is it just sugars that are produced in the leaves and then all the flavor compounds are produced in the grapes, or are other things moved around the vine?
I think that the flavor compound production is pretty much localized to the grapes. It's
yep.
produced in the grapes. And the grapes are a sink. It's a sink and source relationship in plant physiology where the source is the source of all these the photosynthetic products are the leaves.
Yep.
And the sinks in a vine are the growing tips of the leaves
yep.
and the shoots, sorry, and the fruit. So what you really want to do is you want to get a vine so that just about veraison, the leaves and shoots stop growing. And so then the sink becomes the fruit. So the energy is concentrated then to producing properly ripened fruit. And the holy grail of viticulture is to get the balance right between phenolic or flavor maturity
yep.
in the grapes and the sugar maturity. So that when you get full flavor ripeness, you've got sensible potential levels of alcohol.
Okay. And we'll talk about that next week. I think we'll end the show here. Thanks Great. Very much, Jamie.
Nice one.
Okay, I really enjoyed that interview. I know it's a bit geeky, but I didn't realize that the vine had two circulation systems, one for water and one for all the minerals and trace elements. Goes to show I think I need to do a bit more research. Next week, we're going to continue looking at what I consider to be a fascinating look at vines, and we're going to stay with Jamie next week as well, so do stay tuned for that. But let's finish off our mystery grape region. How did you guys go with that? Did you get it? Well, the region is Lodi. It's an American viticultural area in the southern tip of San Juan Valley in California, just east of San Francisco Bay. Here at the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountain, Lodi has some 800 growers farming 800,000 acres of vine on fertile and diverse soils. The region has a Mediterranean-style climate of warm days and cool evenings, and the temperature is moderated by a gentle maritime wind from the Sacramento River Delta. Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, Zinfandel are the big grapes grown here, but others are now flourishing, such as Petit Sirah, Cabernet Franc, Viognier, Grassinio, Tempranillo, and Albarino. However, Zinfandel reigns supreme in Lodi, and there's more grown here than anywhere else in the world, and old vine Zinfandel is a speciality. I hope you got that one. I particularly like Viognier. I drink a bit of Clay Station Viognier from Lodi, and it's really good. One of the better value Viogniers you can try for under £10. And it compares really well against Yalumba in Australia, which I consider to be the new world benchmark for Viogniers. So Lodi can do some nice stuff. Okay, almost finished now. Just one last thing is this week's quote. This week it's from a guy called Kingsley Amey, an English novelist, poet, and critic, as well as a teacher. Seemingly, he wrote more than 20 novels in his time. Here's his quote anyway. A German wine label is one of the things life's too short for. A daunting testimony to the peculiar nation's love of detail and organisation. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.